From UCB Comedy Studios, this is the UCB Digital Podcast. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of this podcast. Really excited that you joined us today for a really exciting episode. Guys, I'm excited every time we talk. Every 2 weeks, I get really excited on Tuesdays. And today is no exception. This was our first live episode, and we're happy to bring it to you. This was an event we had a couple weeks ago, May 9th, at the UCB East Village Theater, where we had a panel discussion, and we called it an inside look at TV development. Some of our friends from the New York Television Festival, True TV, and Omelette Bar Productions, talking about the process of developing your work for long-form television and some of the specific opportunities available at this year's New York Television Festival, which is coming up. Deadline's coming up in a couple of weeks from this podcast release. And a festival coming up in October. A lot of exciting opportunities, and we're excited to bring you this conversation. But first, we have a new segment for you guys. In our last episode, I mentioned that I've been kind of stretching the truth about how often our content has been coming out. Used to be comedy on YouTube and Vimeo. We've had some content coming out, but it's been a little sporadic the last few months. But no more, guys. We're coming back into a content-heavy period at UCB Comedy. And our first series from a digital team here in New York City is about to launch. It's actually launching the same day as this podcast. And so we brought a few of our friends from that digital team in to talk about their work, talk about their series in a new segment we're calling the UCB Comedy Spotlight. So in the bright lights of the UCB Comedy Spotlight today, I've got three members from Fronson & Fronson, Mehdi Barakchian, producer.
Hello.
Hello, Mehdi. Michelle Frankie. Shelly Thomas,
hello.
Producer.
Hello.
And David Sidoroff, director, writer, and fill-in editor when he has to be.
Hello.
Hey, guys. All right, so we're really excited about your new series, Hashtag Target Demo. 60 seconds on the clock. Give me the elevator pitch. What the fuck is Hashtag Target Demo? Go!
Hashtag Target Demo is a satirical sketch series that takes aim at the worlds of advertising, consumerism, marketing, and social media. And a little bit of this crazy world we live in general.
Yeah.
We hope that when advertising companies see this series, they decide to shut the whole industry down because this is
the finishing blow.
Yeah. This should be the final blow. Yeah.
And what are some of the topics you cover in this series? It's a bunch of sketches.
Yeah. They're all sketches that you can watch in any order that you like.
They are all safe for work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's
I think they're all safe for work. Yeah.
Depending on where you work.
Unless
I guess.
You work at Swiffer.
Yes. We tackle everything from social media to apps to wedding hashtags to the company Swiffer.
Yeah, branding.
To airlines.
Branded content. Yeah. We've got commercial parodies. We've got an airline safety video.
And that's a minute.
Great.
Wow.
Look at that. You did it.
I felt good about it.
Plenty of time to spare even, guys.
Yeah.
My palms are sweaty.
Yeah.
My knees are weak and my arms are heavy.
And you're covered with spaghetti.
Mom's spaghetti.
Well, we're super excited about putting this out. So this is starting to come out on the 31st of May, the same day this podcast is releasing.
Today.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You can watch the first episode today.
And if you're listening to this later in the week, in the past.
Yes.
This stuff is already up.
You could go back in time and watch the first episode.
And listen to this while you watch it.
Uh-huh.
And also, if it's before 9:30 right now, you should be on your way to UCB East because you can watch a screening of a couple of our episodes.
Right. Yeah.
Good. I don't have to plug that in the other part of this podcast.
Great. Nice.
But so you guys have been working together on this series. So there's 10 people in your group. You guys have been working on this for maybe like 6-7 months.
That's right.
Yeah.
About?
Yeah.
So how did you guys sort of come around to this concept of Hashtag Target Demo?
Oh, I think, originally we started as like the smart, accessible sketch group.
Yeah.
And we all just kind of like pitched in our ideas of like what we find interesting in the world of sketch right now. And then also from that, it kind of, we all seemed really annoyed and fascinated by the overuse of branding and social media.
Yeah.
And kind of just like spun out from there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's about right. I think this was kind of just naturally something that we all gravitated towards and were interested in kind of tackling as like an umbrella target for the series.
And have you guys all had different experiences working? Has anybody on your group worked in advertising or had experiences in that way? I know we've like cast like Tim and Mujan and like stuff that was like branded before.
Definitely. But, I mean, I've had a little experience in branded content a bit. I don't know about you guys. I know Hudson's done some stuff. She is an incredible graphics and art
wizard, and
just an amazing person in general.
Hudson Meredith, yeah.
She's really unbelievable. Yeah. Like, she knocked it out of the park for every one of our
every of our piece sketches. Of art that you see in all of our sketches. Like that's
she's
the
person to sue if you're the company that's looking to come after us. She's the one who printed most of that stuff.
Good, Maddie's throwing her under the bus. I'm here to defend herself. That's cool.
I've interned at like some. Production companies that were heavily involved in like branded content and stuff. It just kind of makes you like a little sick to your stomach after a while.
We've all watched a lot of commercials.
Yeah,
I've seen a lot of commercials and like passed a lot of ads and stuff. So that's what I bring to the group.
Choose your ad experience.
Watched a lot of commercials. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, sure. Write what you know, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, exactly. Write what you love. Do what you love.
Do
what you love.
I think I'm also excited about this because, as maybe some folks out there know, like you guys actually are the first of the new batch of digital teams here at UCB Comedy to get their content released.
So we won.
Eight teams racing.
we finished first.
Mm-hmm. And you guys finished first. And this is also the first like team that each of you guys has been on.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Yeah. We're all the three new people.
We're all rookies.
We're definitely excited to sort of start to push this thing out there. And also like, what's great about this series is that it also feels like so much of what people sort of came into this team saying was, I want to do stuff that looks like Key and Peele, you know, or Schumer. Yeah. Stuff that has that type of like production aesthetic to it. And definitely it seems like you really hit that.
Yeah, we really definitely wanted to make sure we had high production value.
Yeah. That was a huge goal of ours. Yeah.
Yeah.
And you guys use the YouTube space a lot.
We use it twice.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess that's a third of our sketches.
We utilized that space, and it was really great. It was super helpful, super useful. Like, the aesthetic was exactly what we needed. And, and thank you, Nate.
Yeah.
We love the YouTube space.
Yeah,
it's great.
What type of gear did you wind up using at the YouTube space? Because you can use their studios,
like,
right?
All of it.
You can use their gear.
We used they have a boardroom set that's really great, and we kind of just took the table out of there and reset it to be, spoiler alert, a... Church for a Funeral.
Yeah.
That's one of our sketches.
And it totally reads that way.
And for, spoiler alert, the back end of our, our wedding.
Oh, yeah. We also, there's like a
and
shot of a
well,
wedding there.
Also, we shot an airplane.
Yes.
The interior of an airplane inside their black box studio that they have there.
Yeah.
But we got to utilize, the great thing about that space is that they have everything there and they have some of the best equipment. Like, if you wanted to use a red camera, you could.
Yep.
They have all the, like the C-level cannons there, so we ended up using that, and you know, got all 15 of their like dope Cinema Prime lenses, and just didn't have to lug anything.
Yeah.
We showed up, got
makes
the gear,
it so much and easier.
Went. It's a great resource.
Yeah, they're super helpful. They're
really great. Amazing,
and also cool to sort of be able to repurpose that stuff. So you guys definitely then shot all this stuff as a block, as well. If you're able to sort of repurpose, if you're using that boardroom set as a funeral parlor, and so you sort of shot in blocks.
We did to some extent. I mean, we did the funeral parlor and the wedding shot on the same day. But then the airplane thing was a completely different weekend.
Yeah.
Different day.
That just suited itself well just because that space looked perfect for it. And we just like, you know, a couple flowers and put us in suits. Mm-hmm. We were already in suits. So it was like easy to tag that on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this won't be out right away, but it'll be out later in the week if you're listening to this on Monday. But that's the Swiffer piece as well. You also shot that pretty far off site, too. Where was that shot?
That was at my aunt and uncle's house in Somerset, New Jersey.
In Somerset, New Jersey.
Or Franklin, New Jersey, whatever you prefer.
That's
Franklin
great.
Township,
We loaded up a Chevy Tahoe with everything and took it down there and got there the night before, actually. The three of us in this room got there the night before.
To set up.
To set up for the shoot and to get everything ready. Yeah. And then shot all day, and I can't believe we banged that out in a day. It was like...
Yeah, that's the AD. Oh, that's me. Oh!
Yeah, these guys did a killer job on that, Mehdi and Frankie. Amazing.
And David, like, when you watch it, David did an amazing job of writing it. I'm so in love with that sketch. Like,
thank you.
From every single table read, like, I could not help laughing at it.
It's one of my favorite things to watch from our series, yeah.
Yeah.
And even that set, though, you also multi-use that, right? Because there's also, you double-use the shot of that kitchen.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, we did. It was just kind of like we wanted there to be some small callbacks throughout this series to anyone who watches it all in order. So we have, like, Michelle Sciotta playing the mom, the same mom character in two sketches in the same location.
Yeah.
Which was, like, kind of a fun callback, but also allowed us to kind of double up on production.
And kids.
Yeah.
We doubled up on the kids that we had in those shots.
That's great.
Mm-hmm.
And then
all thanks to that Chevy Tahoe.
Yeah, Chevy. Thank you, Chevy. Chevy keeps America running on Duncan. Thank you, Chevy.
Good. You got your product placement now. As well, the other thing I just want to ask, so then we'll also tune the podcast listeners into this too, because there's also like a high concept thing you guys were trying to achieve that maybe if you just watch the individual sketches, you don't get, right? So tell me about the Fronson brothers and how that
works. Yeah.
The high concept, you got to really be paying attention to.
Yeah, I think.
Because your team is called Fronson and Fronson.
Yes. Right. And so within the team, since we were going after like social media and advertising, et cetera, we were originally thinking like, oh, what would it be like to see like maybe behind the scenes of this ad agency, and then also have some of what their products look like as well, meaning their commercials, et cetera. But eventually it just, you know, evolved into the work that we did, which was great. But we did keep the Fronson and Fronson founders for one of our sketches.
Yeah.
Like I think the general concept is like Fronson and Fronson is this mega ad agency mm-hmm. that's kind of responsible for everything you're seeing and kind of has its tentacles all over the worlds of advertising and social media and kind of pops up in a few different ways.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think that's like kind of it. But that's what's in our heads, at least. And then, there are definitely characters who are, you watch closely, have the Fronson last name.
Yeah.
And maybe this also starts to expand itself as you guys work on the next thing.
Yes.
Maybe. Yeah. Maybe not.
We'll
maybe not. I mean,
but that's the scoop.
We're not married to anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll see. But maybe.
We're dating.
Yeah. You're dating.
We're dating.
We're dating the Fronson and Fronson
idea.
Yeah.
Radical.
All right. So the team is Fronson and Fronson. The series is hashtag Target Demo. Find it on UCB's YouTube and Facebook pages starting May 31st. Thanks for coming in, guys.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. And that's our UCB Comedy Spotlight, which in this circumstance, it kind of services as an advertisement for a series about advertising, which is hilarious. But I hope you guys enjoy that. And hope you guys can check out that series on UCB Comedy's YouTube and Facebook pages. All right. On to the meat of today's episode, the real meat, our live conversation from the UCB Theater with NYTVF, True TV, and Omlibar Productions about television development. A couple of notes about this conversation. It's in two parts. First, we talked to Terrence Gray and Ian Thake from NYTVF about this year's festival and about the opportunities for creators to submit to the festival. Those deadlines are coming up. They talk about them in the episode, and you can also find it at nytvf.com. One note, when we recorded this episode, their Just for Laughs competition was still open, but that submission deadline has passed. But you can still submit to the independent pilot competition and to their script initiative. And again, all the details are on their website. That's part one. And then in part two of the conversation, Ian steps off stage, but we're joined by Christine Walters from True TV and Joe Honig from Omelette Bar Productions to talk about the other side of TV development. So Christine, who is both an awesome improviser and longtime UCB alum, now a senior executive in development at True TV, talks about her perspective on the network side of television development. And Joe Honig, who is a creative and a producer and a jack of all trades, especially on the unscripted comedy side, used to be a field producer for The Daily Show, is the co-creator of the TV show Going Deep with David Reese, talks about her perspective as a producer and a creator in the long-form television development space. So a lot of great information from a bunch of different angles inside of this conversation, and hopefully something that benefits your work in whatever phase of the process you are at. So we're really excited to present this to you. Without further ado, our conversation and an inside look at TV development. All right, that's that hot 6:30 Monday crowd. That's right. Thanks so much for coming out, y'all. We have a good little house here tonight to talk about the exciting world of TV development and the New York Television Festival. By round of applause, who here is interested or is going to be submitting to MITVF this year?
All right.
And who's just here in the game of like trying to get your shit made and paid for just generally? Great. Cool. We're all in that game just generally. But this is great. This is a great opportunity for makers to sort of like
get some food for thought for their process. I'm really excited about it. We're also going to be releasing this panel as a podcast that I host called the UCB Digital Podcast. You can find it every other Tuesday at itunes.com/UCB Comedy. So you'll be able to sort of relive this experience that you're living live right now, but in your headphones on your commute in a couple of weeks. But we're going to do this in two parts. And to start it, I'm actually going to bring up a couple of guys from the New York Television Festival, Terrence Gray and Ian Thaick. Both shake hands like we weren't just standing backstage together.
It's nice to meet you.
Pleasure.
So, guys, New York Television Festival number 16, right? 12?
12.
I gave you a few more years.
Yeah. Yep.
So 12. New York Television Festival number 12 coming up in October.
Late October, yeah.
And so, and your submissions are, what are the submission deadlines, just so everybody has those right out of the gate?
Great. So right now we have the Independent Pilot Competition, which is open from now through June 30th. We have the JFL pitch competition, which is open until next Monday. And we have the NYTVF Scripts Program, which is our inaugural script initiative. And that submissions open June 1st and run through June 15th at noon. There's also an early deadline for the IPC next Monday.
Next Monday, in case anybody wants to get something done between
now and then. You can do it. I believe in all of you.
Now, as far as like those initiatives go, so the IPC is the one that happens every single year, right?
That's correct, yeah.
The other ones are sort of like you have initiatives that sort of happen, and then maybe you have a new initiative the next year and one phases out. How often does that turn over?
I mean, we have a bit of turnaround. Sorry. Just for laughs, it's our fifth year with them doing that. And then NYTVF Scripts, it's sort of the script version of the Independent Pilot Competition. So just, it's very similar.
Yeah, and the thought process behind that, we're lucky enough to have some terrific partners that are development partners of the festival. And one of them is here tonight from True TV, which we're really excited about. And in the past with Scripts, we've done it with Fox. And some terrific writers started amazing careers out of that competition. But one of the things that we learned was, through no fault of our partner, those scripts in that initiative were sort of held. So if somebody became a finalist, if they were in the top 10, they were sort of held back from taking meetings with a lot of the other networks or agents or managers or what have you. And so what we wanted to do was give writers an opportunity to meet with all of our participating companies. And there'll probably be 75, 80 buyers or agents or talent managers that are going to be there. So I think this is a real opportunity if you become a finalist, if you get into the festival, to have your work seen by the entirety of the industry, which I think is exciting.
Yeah, that's really exciting. And in terms of these three categories, what are the genres that you're looking for as far as submissions in each of those three initiatives?
Sure.
With JFL, it's comedy, primarily sketch, but the idea of taking sketch comedy and translating it to traditional television. So it's called like the sketch to screen initiative. So it's like taking past sketch or stand-up experience and taking that kind of in like a Everybody Loves Raymond Seinfeld sort of way and saying like, oh, I want to tell a show. I want to write a show about my family because that's what all my stand-up is about. And so like writing a script based on their experiences or using their sketch and comedy as a proof of talent. IPC is open. It's genreless, so comedy, drama, unscripted, animation, family, web series.
Literally anything.
Literally anything. 4 minutes to 60 minutes in length. And then NYTVF Scripts is 30-minute comedies, but for whatever platform you think it's appropriate. So cable, online, digital, all that jazz.
So it sounds like then, and this is also part of the reason why we're doing this, that this is a comedy-heavy year for you guys.
It is. It is. It's really exciting. I think there's a lot of partners that are coming in this year, some announced, some not announced, at every sort of point along the sort of comedy programming pipeline. And so there's a tremendous amount of buyers that are interested in new voices and authentic voices, and they're coming to the festival and they're looking to fund original comedic programming. And so I think it's something that we've built up a great roster over the last decade or so and working with a lot of great institutions like UCB and having a lot of great people come through and go on to be very successful. So if somebody's sort of in the original comedy game in terms of being a buyer or somebody who wants that material, I think a large percentage of them are going to be at the festival this year and even increased from in years past. So if you're out there, if you're thinking about putting something together, whether it be a script or comedy short or a pilot, we would really encourage you because I think the appetite for comedy this year is really, really strong.
And as part of the festival as well, there are also there are awards that go with the festival, and those awards are generally with partner organizations.
That's right.
Right. So in this the festival this year, what are those opportunities, and what types of projects do you feel like are best suited for those award opportunities?
Sure. I want to make sure I don't misspeak.
We have five announced comedy development partners so far. So CISO, IFC, True TV, Bento Box, and Comedy Central.
Yeah.
Is that five? So they're looking for everything sort of across the comedy spectrum. So some is like unscripted comedy formats, others short form comedy, some is more traditional length comedy. I think IFC is specifically looking for short form, but I don't think anyone is discounting short form. Yeah. So So it's sort of across the board there.
So you're kind of looking for a mix of content to be participant in the festival, but really there are some structural guidelines to what would be appealing to each of those.
Yeah, I think that's right. And we, all of those partners have provided us with a creative brief of what they're looking for. You know, someone like Bento Box is looking and very strong in animation, but they will also be looking at the scripts. They'll be looking at all sort of narrative comedy. Again, Comedy Central sort of across the board. IFC is looking specifically around their comedy crib and short form. But as we all know, there have been things that have started out as short form that have gone on to a life in many different ways, whether it be digital or on the network. True TV, I'm going to hold off a little bit and have Christine come up and talk about it. But the opportunity with comedy formats and what they're doing is incredible. And I think I really encourage you guys to consider this a something like Billy on the Street or something like the Impractical Jokers. These are if you sit down and you study what they're doing on the air, it is a repeatable format, something where it gives you a ton of room to be funny, to be experimental, but within a format that you can put together, you can be hugely successful in that area. And I really encourage you to watch the network, you know, watch At Midnight, watch different things that are going on. There are a ton of other networks that are announcing comedy format stuff. I think USA Today.
Just had the, what's it, Dana Carvey show announced.
Right. And so it's something, it's an area of concentration that I think almost every comedy buyer is looking at it. But True has been an incredible partner for a number of years. Their president, Chris Lynn, is on our board. Christine is amazing. And it's really something to think about.
So let me ask you this. In terms of how creators who are submitting should be thinking about the opportunities that become available through the festival, is the festival, like, how much is the opportunity weighted towards actually finding opportunities to further develop or sell the idea that's being submitted versus access and meetings with people to talk about ideas generally and be identified as somebody to work with in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it's a mix. Obviously, you know, the program that we've tried to sort of create and build up over the last 7 years, NYTVF Connect, is really built around the fostering relationships, you know, creating pathways for independent creators. And part of that is the development deal process and the structure. But there's also, you know, we do a whole educational panel series. We have networking mixers that go on throughout the week of the festival. We have a pretty significantly sized meeting coordination suite where anything that gets into the festival gets put out to all of our industry partners. They request meetings. And I think last year we did something like 450 or so, I'm probably overstating that, but around the 450 mark, of meetings either through the project that got them into the festival or projects that they were pitching once they got in. So, you know, there's that side of things is, I think, stronger than ever. And then we also have a really exciting slate of development deals that, you know, there's, I think there is a good opportunity to, for the project to, that you get into the festival with, to be something that you develop, but it's really about them getting invested in you as a creator or getting invested in your voice because
it's about taking your career to the next level. It's, as Ian said, it's about starting those relationships. It's about putting you on the radar. In some cases, it is about getting that development deal and having the opportunity to go inside the system and develop with the great executives that are associated with the festival. But I really think it's about helping people get to where they want to be. It's about that next stage. And there are a variety of different partners that are developing in different ways. But it's about being a pro. It's about getting paid for what you love to do and for the thing that you've created that you're passionate about. And that's what we try to do. We try to be a connector. And in some instances, continue to work with those producers to get their shows where it needs to be. But that's our main goal. And I think TV or episodic is such a relationship-based business. The opportunity to meet these executives or managers or agents and really get on their radar and have the ability as a pro to follow up and to know how to do that. Or as Ian said, to come to the development chats and hear these executives talk about how they develop with a new creator or how they like to be pitched or what makes a good pitch meeting. I think all of that is very valuable and it's part of the experience of being there. And what we've seen in the last couple of years, the quality of the work is just amazing. And so I think it's a really good point where we are right now. And especially on the comedy side, I think there's a lot of good feeling towards the producers that are coming through the festival. And I think, you know, there's a lot of excitement going into the fall.
Cool. And then as far as, and you spoke to the quality of the work as well, and this is a question. In terms of submitting to the festival, how much does production quality of the work being submitted factor into acceptance or, you know, or denial from the festival itself? Is it about, like, how do you weigh the idea, and in the comedic sense, the comedic premise of this show versus the production quality available to an independent, you know, self-financed creator at the time? How does that factor in your process?
I'm going to let the head of programming take that one and maybe I'll follow
Thank
up
you.
On his heels.
So I think, you know, it's a mix. I think as we've gotten sort of more and more years of the festival, it's sort of changed in both ways. One, I think the barrier for entry in terms of production quality is a little bit lower in terms of like, it doesn't need to necessarily look like it's ready to go on television today, because anything that comes through the festival, obviously, if it got a development deal, if anything happened, there would be further development with that idea. But we don't want production value to be distracting, I think is probably the main thing that we're looking for. So it's less the idea that it looks perfect and could be on television, more like I can't hear what anyone's saying or I can't see this character, which is a problem that happens more often than you might imagine. I think with comedy, obviously, it's also slightly lower because it really is that voice, that comedic strength that's driving what you're doing. And so production can sort of go to the secondary in that case. On the other hand, with, you know, the internet and the democratization of sort of all of these tools that are available to people, there is the expectation that it will look somewhat professional. There are, I think Victor Varnado was on one of our panels a couple of months ago, and he just talked about the fact that, like, he didn't know how to do anything, but he just watched YouTube tutorials for everything and then suddenly became maybe not a master at everything, but like was able to do all of the things that he needed to do to submit a project because it's all out there for you. So obviously there are people you can hire to make something look more professional, but you also don't discount just putting in time. That's something you have that, I mean, again, the deadline's approaching, but it's...
Yeah, right.
It's limitless.
Monday.
Limitless.
But you do have a little bit more time to, like, you know, learn something. And if you're like, oh, I can't hire an editor, then spend, you know, 3 hours watching editing videos because there's a way to learn those skills.
Definitely spend money on sound. If it's not there, it's just not going to be... And people are going to tune out immediately. But everything Ian said, and also don't be afraid to reach out to people in the community that are doing this. Like, if you can find somebody who's edited comedy before, it's going to help you tremendously, try to find that person or someone who's edited before. And you know, what we find in the festival is people always tell stories about the idea that artists in general are willing to help each other out. So do your best, go online, do the things, like search for people that are like-minded, that want to put together a terrific project and see what you can do. You'd be surprised how much people are willing to help out.
People will also do a lot for a slightly better credit than they're used to getting in other projects. So it's like, oh, I can't pay you, but how about you're my director of photography for this project? Right. You know, like giving them more responsibility, letting them rise to that occasion, and also just, giving them a credit that they can put on IMDb and it looks good and it's for a project that they believe in.
You do get quite a variance of production budget though, right? I remember the year that I was in the festival, like 3 years ago, I remember doing the Q&A, and obviously the question at the Q&A is always, how much money did you spend on this?
Right.
Someone always asks that question at Q&As, right? And I remember that the group that we were paired with said that they spent like $50,000. And we were like, I think we bought some lasagna one day.
The people with the really good stories. Yeah, I got pizza for everyone. Yeah. And no, I feel like everyone to a certain extent, we don't get a ton of the 50 grand and up. But I think, you know, if you beg, borrow, and deal, and as Ian said, whether it's credits or whether, you know, just thanking people and bringing them into your world and seeing what you can do for them. There's a lot of tech that's out there that we all know is sort of cost effective. Do the best you can, but at the end of the day, spend your time developing whatever it is before you start to do any production. Put as much time as possible into the script, into the format, into whatever you're doing, because once you start spending money, you are spending money. So I can't encourage you enough to do all of the homework that you can do prior to actually getting into physical production.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the first show that sold out of the festival, which was an unscripted format in 2006. Is that true?
Yes.
James Murray.
Yes. It was, 2005.
2005, sorry. That the first show that sold was, I think, he spent $300 production budget, and that was just the bar tab at the bar where he recorded the
pilot. And that guy is extremely successful today. He literally rented out a bar and got some actors to come in and join. And literally, I think he had to pay the guy $300, and he put everything together himself. And now he's the star of Impractical Jokers, and which is on in several countries around the world. And he's selling out Radio City Music Hall. So, it can definitely happen. And, if we're talking about James, the one thing, outside of his talent, an extremely hard worker, and a pro. And we have a lot of people that come to the festival that say, you know, be a good person, be professional, be a pro, and that can go a really, really long way.
And last question before we move into the next section of this, and that is that MYTVF is right now also going beyond just the festival, right? You guys are expanding your production, right?
Yeah. So 2 years ago, we started NYTVF Productions, and it was with the idea that with some of our development partners that had a lot of faith in us in terms of curating and finding great new voices, knew that we had relationships with all the top agencies and were able to produce and develop further. And so with those partners, we have now begun developing and producing work that's coming out of the festival. This past week, our first independent series that we did in partnership with The Orchard, who had an award out of the festival in 2014, is a series called The Jams. And we caught a break and did a deal with Netflix. And so it went up on Netflix a week ago.
Awesome.
We're real psyched about that. And we did another comedy out of a Fox competition called Semi-Charmed Life. And that is something that we're getting ready to take to the market right now. But did a pilot with Ryan Hansen and Noelle Wells and John Stern from Wet Hot American Summer. And so just terrific partners that have been involved with us.
Yes, absolutely.
And several projects several projects in development that I don't believe I can talk about with other partners.
But you guys, but MYTVF as an organization is growing along with the festival and along with the artists who participate in the festival.
Yeah, I mean, and everything we're doing from the NYTVF production side really is just to further the mission, hopefully, of the NYTVF, which is sort of promoting these creator voices. You know, the jams co-created, the two co-creators and the stars, like we're working with them to develop the series. We're trying to make them, you know, we're sort of the connective tissue. That's what we're trying to be. I couldn't think of that word for some myelin sheaths is what I was thinking of, but that's where yeah. The myelin sheaths. But you know, we're just trying to make the process easier and hopefully create more opportunities.
Yeah, and take great projects that are coming out of the festival and try to see them through to fruition. I mean, that's the main part. And it's been a wonderful experience with great partners and great artists that have come out of the festival. And so far, so good. We've really enjoyed it.
Cool. Well, thanks so much, guys. And we'll now transition this into a more of a conversation specifically about development and about some of the opportunities we're just talking about. So we'll bring up Christine Walters and Joe Honig. Hey. So let's maybe just walk through like you guys' jobs as they consist right now. I mean, Christine, you are no stranger to this stage and this place.
No, I am not.
And have built a career in comedy as a producer, as well as somebody who's worked as a writer and on the development side as well. So in your capacity at Truth TV now, what is it that you're, what are you doing these days?
What am I doing these days? My title at Truth TV is Executive Producer of Development and Original Programming. So it is definitely a sort of 50-50 split. Half of my time is spent looking for talent to bring to the network that seems to have a voice that's kind of in keeping with the tone and feel of the network. Looking for projects, encouraging people to bring their projects to us, coming to this theater many, many nights a month to look at shows and people. And then the other half of my job is in the original programming side, which is supervising series that make it to air or pilots that we hope will make it to series. So that's pretty much in a nutshell what I do.
And you also have had, you were also an alum of the NYTVF as a creator as well, right?
Yeah, I have way too many
interconnections
here. I'm a former performer at the UCB. Uh-huh. Nate shot and edited a web series that did a million years ago before I was at True that had a 20 episode run. I was an alum of the 2012, I believe, or 2011. I can't remember which festival.
We'll say 2012.
And my husband has been an alum of the festival as well. So, and Joe and I work together, not just at True TV now that Joe is developing and producing projects for us, but she and I worked together many years ago. She was my boss for a stretch of time at Idiot Box Productions.
It's like old home week here.
Oh, my God. Know. Yeah. Anybody else I know? Yeah, any family members? Anybody out there I should know?
All the crossover.
Yeah.
And Joe, for you now, you are at Omelet Bar Productions, which you own. Yes. But you're also inside of, and where we met was at True Entertainment, which is different than True TV, which comes up all the time.
So confusing, right?
It's very confusing, and it's created some really embarrassing incidents where people, when I was the head of development at True Entertainment, I was the executive vice president of development at True Entertainment until this past December, people would come to meetings with me thinking they were coming to True TV and start pitching me shows like I was a network executive and say, oh, this is going to be great for your network's demographic, and start like pitching. Yeah. And I had to like interrupt them in the middle and say, do you think you're at True TV, the network? Because I'm just a production company. I can't buy anything from you. Yeah. So I was the head of development at True Entertainment. And then in this January, I made a new deal with them where I own Omelet Bar Productions, which has an overall deal with True Entertainment, which means basically that instead of running the whole development for a large reality TV company, I instead get to sort of have a more boutique company that is just stuff I'm developing under my own shingle. I focus pretty much on unscripted comedy, and they fund, you know, my salary and an assistant and some development money and an office, and I get to use the, you know, lawyers and the accountants and all that stuff. And it's a great opportunity to sort of be more independent and just focus on what I want to do, but still have like the shelter of a large company, because when you're selling TV shows, one of the things that people look for a lot at places like True TV is, you know, an infrastructure so that when they give their money to you, it doesn't just like go.
You don't go to Mexico.
Exactly. Or it doesn't like go into your bank account and you pay the rent with it. So like, you know, it's a great, for me, it's the best of both worlds because I can be small and independent, but I have a large infrastructure that makes people confident in handing over checks.
So we're sort of looking, have a lot of different experience here, a lot of different sides of the process that goes towards getting TV shows made, right? So I guess like on a development side, and maybe this is like, I guess on the development side of your job, Christine, what is the day-to-day of a development executive look like, broadly?
Three martini lunches. No, none of that, actually. I guess there's no like, now I do development, now I do sure. production, now, you know, it's kind of all intertwined. I would say a lot of it is just like keeping things on track. And some of it is hand-holding for creators who are, you know, hitting a rut maybe in trying to figure out what their show is. Some of it is, you know, celebrating breakthroughs in coming up with that show is. But development is not a fast process, I would say. It requires a lot of patience. And I think a lot of people walk in the door thinking, great, you like my idea, let's make it. And it takes a little bit more time than that, because even though a network might see promise in an idea, it doesn't mean it's fully baked and ready to go. So there is that thing of a pilot is a roadmap for what a series would be. And it is our greatest hope that if we can get to series, it would be a series that would last for season to season to season to come. So I think there's this like very, maybe it's like the TV version of what a network executive is. It's like a person who likes to like crap all over people's ideas and be like, it's not. It's a person who is on your side. And like, if they recognize something in you and really like your idea, they are your biggest cheerleader and they want to see it succeed. Because if that succeeds, it's great for the network, right?
Well, because your relationship with somebody who's coming in with a show, right, in a package, is about like you're now putting you're doing your job, but that's also like there's risk there, right? There's risk in the process, and so you want things to succeed the same way that somebody coming in with an idea wants that opportunity to succeed as well.
Yeah, absolutely. It's definitely a relationship where I'm going to be putting just as much of my time into your idea as you are for the most part. So I want it to be an idea that I can get behind and that I really care about and that I do want to champion, because, you know, everybody answers to someone. So, you know, I have to upsell it to the president of the network. And I need as much ammunition as I can get to be able to do that. Yeah.
In thinking about, and I guess maybe this also relates to the other side of the product, like looking at it from a production company side too, like I guess what's the balance of how many projects are you guys focused on in your jobs? And I guess this crossed over you too, Terrence, at any given time, knowing how slow the process is it about keeping a lot of balls in the air or is it about focusing on a few that you put a larger investment into?
It's kind of both, and I think it depends on the kind of the size of the production company. When I was running development for True, it was, you know, we were developing 20 things at a time, because one of the things that you start realizing when you're in development as a career is that, you know, people are pitching Christine all day, you know, or maybe not all day, but like she hears 20, 30 pitches a week, you know, and you spend, if you're working on one pitch for 6 months and you have your one meeting with the network, you're going to go pitch. It's like the pitch meeting is 2 weeks from Thursday and that's the only thing you've been planning for all this time. You know, it's a lot of eggs in that basket. But if you can kind of be getting a bunch of ideas going, it gets you a lot further. But if you spread yourselves too thin, then you lack quality in the ideas. So, I mean, in my new smaller capacity, I'm trying to work on like five ideas at a time, you know, and, you know, taking out one or two pitches at a time maximum. I feel like that's, you know, again, I'm sort of doing a more boutique thing. A lot of the bigger companies, they're just churning out lots and lots of ideas.
And on the network side, is it similar? Is it?
Well, I mean, we have a
big volume at the beginning.
Well, we have a big department,
yes,
too. I'm not the only entry point for development.
Sure.
There are other development people at the network, different pods, we'll call them, of people who take in pitches. But for me personally, you know, I could say my current workload is I have one series that I'm supervising and three pilots and a presentation in addition to that, and then on top of that I'm pitching constantly to my executives that I report to, pitching ideas that come into me. So yeah, about that.
Yeah, and I think for us, you know, we're limited in terms of what we're doing in development because we're just doing it with the partners that we're in business with, so we're not developing outside of our partners in the festival and the people that are coming through. But I think to Christine's point, it's just something to bear in mind. Like, she's doing current and she's doing development. And so I would say to people who are submitting who might be in the festival, it's a good lesson. And, you know, if you are able to get a meeting with True, you really, knowing and hearing about her day, you really want to be that pro. You really want to be that person that Christine wants to get an email from. So bear in mind how much of her schedule is taken up by the different things that she's doing. And if she doesn't get back, it might not be because she doesn't like what you said in the email, but maybe wait the requisite amount of time, go back as a pro. And if she says to you, you know, during a meeting, email me, I know, Chris, like, she'll get back. But it's one of those things, and I know I'm sort of harping on it a little bit, but people are super busy with both current and development, and both of those things are, you know, a lot of time. So just bear that in mind when you're talking with people, and just try to approach it that way so that when you do get your shot, you know, you come off in a professional way.
Yeah, I mean, we know good ideas come from everywhere. And I think True, especially as a network, is very open to people who may not have that pathway, like a manager or an agent. You know, we are willing to look at people's submissions. You know, it is hard when somebody sends you an email and they've sent you links to 12 things that they've done. Like, the best thing to do is pick those two best things that you've done, or, you know, just to narrow it down, because as Terrence said, you know, it is time consuming to watch 12 different projects. Like, you really should narrow it down to the thing that you feel is the strongest.
And in terms of like going into a meeting to make a pitch as a first step on both sides of this process, what are the elements of that presentation that feel like they are the most value to the process? Is it about having something that's fully baked? Is it about having something that has tape associated with it? Where's the most value to the presentation? And maybe how do you prepare for a presentation and thinking about presenting your idea?
I think the most important thing I've learned over the years is something that Christine just touched on, which is the network executive really wants to buy a show from you. They really want your show to be a good idea. They need your show to be a good idea. It's a symbiotic relationship where you need to go in with something that will help them help their bosses buy the show, right? So it's not like there's a back and forth there, and what you need to go in with is ammunition for them to take it up the line. And so depending on what the idea is, I mean, sure, they'll help you bake things if it's a brilliant idea, but really what you should be able to do is, in whatever way you need to, draw a clear picture of what your show is, so that, and do it in such a way that when the network executive, because most of us don't pitch the person with the bag of money that they're going to put on the table and say, make 10 episodes. You know, most of us are pitching people who need to pitch it to other people who oftentimes need to pitch it to other people. So what you really need to go in the door with is a roadmap, if it's video, if it's paper, if it's like a piece of talent that you have video of something that they've done, something that they can very clearly and easily take your voice and your sales pitch and your point of view and translate it on to the other people, because, you know, you'll ultimately, you're a partner with that network executive in trying to make it a success for both of you. So I don't think, I think video, you know, it really helps. Sometimes I often pitch like formats, comedy formats along the lines of a Billy on the Street or an At Midnight, things that are not necessarily talent driven, things that aren't necessarily scripted. And for those things, I often make sizzle reels that just explain the format, you know, that just have clips and stock footage that just sort of walks you through the best way to pitch the format, not because it's like I'm selling you this footage, but because I know that now I've said it the way I want to say it and I've communicated it in the strongest way possible. And then Christine can take it and show it to other people. And it's much easier for her to make that vision clear to other people.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. And the only other thing I would add is if you are doing something for True, and this is whether it's the festival or outside of it, and you may not have access to a particular talent that you want to see in it, like as Joe said, like, you know, use found footage, but have a very distinct format, have a very clear idea of that of what you're bringing, Chris. And I think if you have that, she will work with you and collectively with agencies or whatever, you'll find that talent, but really be crisp on what you're coming in with, that it's a repeatable format, that they could make 100 episodes of it and really just have your story down, I think. And then other elements that you might not have access to right now could come together.
And you're also, and I think there might be a divide here too, just in terms of, you're also approaching this from the perspective of a producer, right? Talent, is it almost the reverse? And maybe this is a question. For somebody who's coming in as talent, as somebody who's like, I'm a comedian and I want to sell my project, you know, a project for me in whatever capacity that is.
Right.
The hypothetical me. Then it's less about the format
what
and more about the identity.
Let's talk about it. Come on, let's get down to it. I think the most important thing for a talent who walks in the door who has a vehicle that they're building for themselves is to really understand why you are that unique voice who needs to be the face of this show. Because it needs to feel authentic, it needs to feel organic, it shouldn't feel like, well, I want to be on TV and this is my best shot to get there. I mean, I think, you know, when you watch a show, like you watch Billy on the Street, you know he is a person who absolutely devours pop culture, lives, breathes, eats it. And that is so key to the success of that show. He's not faking who he is. I mean, he's playing a heightened version of himself, just barely. I mean, he's an amazing talent. But part of it is that underlying thing that this is a genuine love that he has, right? And I don't think you could think of really anybody else who could do that show, right?
I would agree. I think as far as talent goes, I mean, oftentimes I, as a producer, look, one of the things I do is look for talent to build a show around. And I tell managers and agents, I say, you know, or people at UCB, I say, you know, if somebody is really funny, has a distinct point of view, has a great voice, but doesn't know what to do, they should come to me or somebody like me and I can talk to them and hear, because the show can't be, look at me, I'm funny. The show needs to be whatever it is. So a lot of times pairing them with a producer or a writer, depending on what it was, before you go in to pitch so that you can kind of have a point of view of what the show's going to be mm-hmm. beyond the talent is helpful in developing something. But a lot of times also the network, if they love a person, will pair you.
Right. I mean, I think that's the other side of the equation is, you know, we've had plenty of instances where we like a talent and we want to find a way to work with them on air. And so we will, if they are not a writer talent, potentially put them together with someone who can help them see that vision through.
Yeah. It's funny to sort of talk in absolutes, right? Because it's all so project case dependent. But I guess like in thinking at that level, how much does that full package, how much do you feel like that full package of seeing both, of walking in with both sides of that, how, like maybe percentage wise, is that like 30% advantage? Does it even, can you even quantify it? Like, Or does it matter at all? It doesn't affect.
And you're talking about both the talent and the producer
and the
being
production
together.
Yeah, the viability and the track record of everybody associated with the project from that first touch point. Doesn't matter.
I would say in my experience with selling shows, the times I have gone in with, I made a show called Going Deep with David Reese.
Great show.
Thank you. Your people were connected.
That's right. Yeah. That's our connection.
You may have been connected a little bit. Anyway, that show, it's a how-to show about things you already know how to do. And that show is a good example of actually all the things we're talking about.
Yeah.
In that my other friend, Christine, and I knew David Reese and thought he was really funny and interesting. And he wrote this book about pencil sharpening. And we thought, you know, wow, he's got a voice, but what do we do with it? And, you know, if I had called up my network contacts, all my friends at, you know, various networks and said, hey, I want to make a show about an artisanal pencil sharpener. Are you guys interested? You want to bake it with me? You want to develop it with me? They would have all been like, no, you know, no, thank you.
Yeah.
But instead, we sat around and we figured out what this format is and that he has this voice and that he likes to learn really, really complicated things about really, really simple things. And has a joy of learning, so we made a sizzle tape for it, and we took it out and pitched it to a whole bunch of people who didn't seem that interested in hearing the pitch. And then we got four offers, to make the show from four different networks, all of whom never you would imagine making a show about, you know, making how to make an ice cube. And I think that is because it was so clear, and the talent was so obviously good at what he was doing, and the voice of the show was so clear, and how many what the refillability of the episodes was going to be was so clear that, you know, it had a lot of people who, you know, who weren't necessarily asking for shows about artisanal pencil sharpeners wanting to buy it. And I've had that experience a number of times of ideas where it's the last thing anybody's asking for, but because we made such a clear picture and it was so easy, the roadmap was so clear because the talent was there, because the idea was there, that it sold a lot faster. I do agree that when you have like a format and you're like, oh, and it's going to star, you know, Brad Pitt, there's no point in trying to make a deal with Brad Pitt before you pitch it. Because frankly, even if Brad Pitt wants to make your show, the network is going to have to make a big fancy money deal with them anyway after they buy the show. So unless, you know, for the most part, who the host is going to be, unless they're intricately involved in making the pilot the way David was with Going Deep, you can't really offer talent up to a network unless you can't really lock them up on the level that's actually relevant. You know, so it doesn't really matter.
Right.
It's nice to have ideas to paint pictures with, but again, if you have talent that's less famous, who's a part of the production team that's making it all happen, that's great because it makes it easier for them to see the show when you're pitching it. Did I lose the thread there?
No.
Okay. No, but I think it does. It helps tell what the tone of the show would be. You know, there's a big difference between a show with, you know, Gilbert Gottfried and one with Brad Pitt, you know, so it does. It's almost like an indicator of, oh, I understand where you're going with this.
So like I pitched a show last week that was a found footage stock tape about a format idea. And in one part of the tape, we wrote, here's some people we're thinking of for hosts. And we try not to put Brad Pitt in because if you do that, then the network is like, oh, you're never going to get Brad Pitt. This show sucks, and throws it out. But if you like put in
do that all the time.
All the time.
Nothing but Pitt.
But if you put in some, you know, reasonable comedic talent that, you know, is maybe well known, but, you know, might be a stretch, maybe they want the job, you can just put some pictures in just to give them an idea. And then, you know, it's 10 seconds of the tape and then you move on. And
and also, it's set for tone. Like, it helps paint a picture.
What in the process, knowing that it involves patience and knowing that can be prolonged, and there's no guarantees ever, right?
It that, always takes longer, right? Like, that's right? Just... like
construction, or, you know, whatever. It just always takes longer.
Yeah, it takes longer and the costs go up, right? But what is, I guess, maybe what are the tenets of, like, a productive dialogue throughout that process? How does that relationship look over time? Is it is it sort of like evenly paced? Is it in bursts? Like what's an efficient like dialogue throughout the process look like as far as advice for people who are like looking to get into the process?
I guess that's a kind of a case by case basis too, I think.
It all is, huh?
Yeah. I mean, it is.
No, we're trying to nail down the wind here, you know?
Yeah. I mean, a lot of it is in the deal making. Like before you even get to make the thing, you have to make the deal to make the thing. But you're talking about before you even get to the point where you would make a deal
yeah.
on the thing.
On the network side, it's like you like the idea. You like the sort of collaborative potential of the collaborative relationship. To move forward, I guess, what's the sort of like, what's the attitude to take towards that relationship? It's like any relationship. You don't want to be too pushy, too needy, right? You don't want to ghost them, you know? But I guess that's like, I guess maybe are there any tenets of that dialogue that feel like they'd be valuable advice, I guess?
I guess I would say, you know, don't look to the network to create your idea for you. Like, I think a lot of people have a seed of an idea and then they keep coming back asking you to help them to make it the show, which is part of the job. But really, it's, you know, I have to feel like you're putting as much effort into it as I'm putting into it. And I think there are a lot of times where there are more questions asked than answers given. And so I think it's that. It's like be willing to put in the time and the work and, you know, not to try to put it on the other person.
I think that's fair. That's good advice.
I think... Definitely, if you get the opportunity and it looks like you're rolling towards something, be super passionate about what your idea is, what your project is, because you want Chris to be passionate to everybody else on her group and really get behind it. So I would say that that's certainly...
Yeah, and I don't mean to say like we're not collaborative. It's just that there are times where you feel like the person is just waiting for you to fill in the blanks for them. And really... I think a lot of it has to be coming from the creator.
I'm just laughing because I don't think anybody's ever had that experience with me as a creator. But I think that there's a really, besides obviously like doing the work yourself, there is a balance to figure out to be a good producer or a good creator of like figuring out how to hear what the network wants and how to develop it to work for their network, but also to not ask questions and to just do what they say, because it's your job to critically analyze everything they say to figure out how to make the show the strongest show it can be. So as I think it's a real balancing act in the development process to figure out how to keep the show as much as it should be and change it as much as it needs to change and still maintain that it exists as a show. Because a lot of times people, I feel like, just kind of morph with the wind and just do anything anybody suggests because they're trying too hard to please. And pleasing is great, and it is a business, and they are your client, and you are executing work for them. But you're not really doing your client or the network any favors if you don't look at what they're saying with a critical eye and really try to analyze what it is they want and figure out how best to give them what they want, because they're not going to do the work for you. So if they just happen to say, oh, you know what, we really think it'd be great if that set was blue, and then they go on to do something else, then you know you have to sit there and think about why they want the set to be blue and figure out how to make it blue even though we already ordered it in pink. And also, you know, is blue really going to get the effect they want and make it what they want so that it's, and then is that going to be a success for all of you when the show actually gets to air? Yeah. So it's a constant question asking process and trying to be constructive, not defensive, not overly protective, but also not overly wishy-washy.
Yeah, absolutely. And not a lot to add to that, but I would say for emerging producers who may be going through the process for the first time, that the network is going to know their brand and they're going to know their audience better than anyone. So don't be overly rigid, but then don't just, you know, be a pushover on the other side either. I mean, there are certain aspects of your show that are really core to it. And don't be afraid to come back on a note and at least have a dialogue about it and say, hey, I feel super strongly about this. It might not work this particular way, but could I go back and work on this and see if we can save this and do it another way? But that's the thing. Don't be afraid to speak up. Don't be afraid to speak your mind, but also don't be like, this is my Picasso. It cannot change an inch, because at the end of the day, they're running a business and they know it better than anyone else. So you have to kind of find that fine line in between, but don't be afraid to stick up for the things that you believe in, especially if you have the opportunity to work with a good executive.
And I think actually they appreciate it in the end. Yep. The network appreciates it when you are thinking and analyzing and questioning and, you know, going back and forth. They're not going to get mad at you, you know, unless you like unreasonably dig your heels in about something and refuse to have a conversation. They're looking for you.
Well, they want you to have conviction in your project. And I think if you are so quick to, yes, we'll do this, yes, we'll do that, I think there is a feeling of, oh, so you just want to get this made versus you really believe in this. And we want to believe in you believing in it. So I think that's really what I'm coming after, is a lot of people, they're just like, well, what do you want? What do you want? What do you want? Which tells me you don't know what you have. So so I think it's that thing of, you know, it is a collaborative process, but it has to start with you believing in what you're doing.
Great. I think that's great advice. And just to sort of like land this, and maybe we have a couple of time for a couple of questions, but in terms of NYTVF and how True TV is looking at NYTVF this year, I guess, what are you looking for from artists at NYTVF this year specifically? What's the opportunity? What's the initiative? And what should people be sort of like, the mindset people should have going towards that festival in particular?
I think we're really looking to meet people and have a dialogue with them, more so than, is your project absolutely perfect for the network? I think a lot of it is just seeing promise in what you're doing. And I think most people will tell you, it's usually not the first project that you get in the door. That's the calling card to then start the relationship to be able to work on the next project. So very rarely is it like, that's the thing, let's put it on air tomorrow. I don't know.
That's where the money bag guy comes in.
Right. Yeah.
You got the
dollar bills and the big Yosemite Sam mustache. So yeah, I think a big part of NYTVF for True is just seeing the landscape of who's creating out there that we may not get to know otherwise, seeing if there's any potential there for people. We have, you know, not just long form shows, but we're also doing a show called Late Night Snack, which is curated short form content, and you know that just started airing about 2 or 3 months ago. And that's also something where I feel like there's a lot of opportunity for creators at NYTVF who are working currently in the short form space to maybe have an entry point into the network. And that's sort of how we see that show. I mean, we think it's a great show because it has so much variety in it, but part of the impetus for doing the show was to be able to work with more creators and collaborators, because not everybody is going to get a half hour series, but to be able to work with people in 2 to 3 minute long increments is a little bit easier to start that relationship.
Awesome. I think we probably have time to take maybe 3 questions in total. Can we get a little bit of light so we can see people? Hello, everybody. All right. I saw the first hand right in the middle. Sir, go ahead. What's your question? Yeah. So if anybody couldn't hear that in the back, the question is, how helpful is the type of scenario of it's this meets this, or to like sort of compare yourself to work that exists?
It's great to have a strong log line. I think that's a great way to get people's attention, but there has to be something obviously beyond that.
Can't just drop the mic.
In my experience with pitching ideas, you can do the it's this meets that if neither of those things are actually the things you're doing. For instance, I pitched a show once that was it's Martha Stewart meets Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. So it was a funny, and it, you know, it's very clear. We ended up being a show called Craft Corner Deathmatch, which somebody bought 12 episodes of.
Launched Jason Jones' career.
Yes, Jason Jones hosted. Yeah. Anyway, that was a good time. But the point is, if you're doing that, I think you get a better response to that sort of thing. If you are a comedian or a performer, it's better just to show how you're funny than to tell people how you're funny, because that tends to make people say, well, if it's like Baskets, I'll watch Baskets. So, you know, it's sort of usually finding a way to show your voice rather than tell them what your voice is tends, I think, to be the most effective way.
And if you set the expectations to, like, I'm going to be as funny as Zach Galifianakis, then that is a lot to, you know, come through on. Not saying that you can't, but it's setting the expectation bar really high.
And it sets people, like, it sets you up against something, right, which isn't necessarily the easiest way to make yourself look good.
Cool.
I think you can quickly maybe reference something for tone, but I think everything that these guys are saying is right. And like Zach's a pretty high mark, so just
take it. Two more. Yeah, right here. So this is another question towards the independent pilot competition. Can you submit a short film as a pilot?
Yeah. I mean, if there's a way in which in that short film you can make it slightly shorter and kind of leave it open, that would be helpful. But the answer is yes, you can. And by the way, Aaron Day, the festival director, and Emily is here. Guys, we're going to be hanging out. I know we're short on time, but if there are questions for the NYTVFers, we'll be out in the lobby probably drinking a beer or doing something.
Yeah.
Yes.
Cool.
Oh, I just didn't want
to. No, and maybe that question relates to the last question that I'll ask, which is just that, like, in terms of looking at independent work, like at the MITVF, mm-hmm, I guess, like, in looking at work, we asked the question before of MITVS, how much does production quality matter? How much does that matter in looking at it, in looking at, like, somebody's work towards a development opportunity?
I think it's the idea more than the quality of, you know, no one expects you to have the best DP or the best, you know, sound mixer or any of that. It really starts with the idea. And as Terrence said, you know, having a beginning, middle, and end, like not just having the seed of an idea that doesn't really pay off in any way. And as Aaron said, you know, showing that there is... It leaves a question in your mind of, ooh, I want to see more. Like, oh, they've set up this amazing world that I can see infinite possibilities for. Because that's really, the repeatability is such a huge part of television. Not so much in film, but in television, that's the biggest thing. Like, ooh, I want to follow this character. I want to know what happens next to him or her. So I think, you know, leaving that question in people's minds is important too.
Cool. Well, like Terrence said, I think we're going to go out to the bar. But thank you to everybody on the panel, Christine and Joe and Terrence and Ian. Ian's got one more thing to say.
Oh, hey, everybody. So if you are interested in submitting to the NYTVF, we do have a deadline a week away. But if you're here tonight, we do have vouchers that get you the early submission fee up until June 15th, just to give you an extra month to get your idea together. So if you'd like that voucher, Emily, who you might have seen when you checked in, she has red hair and a black and white striped shirt. She's got these vouchers that'll get you a little bit more time. So ask her for those, and thank you guys.
Special reward for people coming tonight. Those of you listening on the podcast right now, you lost out. But you can find this as a podcast to relive this great night at itunes.com/UCBComedy in about 2 or 3 weeks. Thanks again, and see you soon. Bye-bye. And that will do it for episode number 26 of the UCB Digital Podcast. I hope you guys enjoyed that conversation as much as I did. Thanks again to our friends Terrence Gray, Ian Thake, Christine Walters, and Joe Honig for sitting down at that live event a couple weeks ago to talk about their process and their work in the world, in the fun, expanding world of television development. So thanks to those guys for doing it. Thanks to you guys for listening. And thanks to Fronson and Fronson for sitting down with us. And don't forget, check out their new series on UCB Comedy right now. It's available. If you're listening to this,
their series is available. Go watch it. Hope you guys enjoy it. If you enjoy this podcast, don't forget, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Connect with us, UCB Digital Podcast on Facebook, at UCB Digital on Twitter. And as always, subscribe, rate, review, and leave us a comment on iTunes.com/UCB Comedy. We love to connect with you guys and would love to answer your questions. Tell us what you're watching. Tell us what you like. Tell us an episode you want to hear on this podcast. We're very open to communication. This is a two-way stream, guys. And we would love to connect with you. Hey, I'm no longer stretching the truth. You can find new videos on youtube.com/UCB Comedy. And very soon we've got more brand new fresh content coming out at vimeo.com/UCB Comedy. You can always connect with UCB Comedy on all forms of social media at UCB Comedy. And until next time, guys, we'll see you on the internet.
This has been a UCB Comedy production. Check out our other shows on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network.